It's Tuesday, January 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, Islamic State claims responsibility for the deadly New Year's attack in Turkey. North Korea says it may soon have an intercontinental ballistic missile.
It sounds like a fairy tale, but we are really in advanced stages.
Exciting developments in treating liver cancer. Also ahead, at the movies, a monster calls. It's all on today's International Edition. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility for a New Year's attack on a nightclub in Istanbul, Turkey, that left 39 people dead and authorities searching for a shooter who got away. The group said in a statement a soldier of the caliphate carried out the shooting. Turkey's deputy prime minister said that authorities have obtained the fingerprints and basic description of the gunman and say they're close to identifying him. They also confirmed reports that 8 people have been detained in connection with the assault. VOA's Sarah Williams spoke with Charlie Winter, research fellow at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization at King's College in London, and asked him how Islamic State has characterized this attack.
Based on the claim of responsibility that the Islamic State has produced, they are trying to brand it as something that has been centrally directed, rather than an attack which is being carried out by a supporter who has perhaps spoken with individuals within the Islamic State, and they've egg them on to carry out a stabbing attack or something like that. In this instance, the Islamic State is saying, we ordered this, one of our operatives carried this out, and it is something which was orchestrated from within Syria or Iraq. So that matters because it points towards a logistics network, it points towards much more complicated planning, and I think it's all geared towards potentially representing a sea change in the Islamic State's agitation in Turkey. This is a point which it's trying to make through this attack. It's saying the years where we've been kind of having a fairly ambiguous presence in your country are over, and now the war is being brought to you. And this is something which has come through a lot in the Islamic State's propaganda over the last few months.
Why Turkey?
Why Turkey? Well, I mean, there are a load of reasons, really. But one of the key ones right now is the fact that the Turkish army is involved in northern Syria and actually making serious headway against the Islamic State in what has been a very, very important province or area that's been under its control for a number of years now. So Aleppo province is shrinking by the day, and that is having a profound impact upon the Islamic State organization and its insurgency in Syria, and with a knock-on effect in Iraq as well. So what the Islamic State needs to do is show that it is still a potent force and show that there is no encroachment on its territory without retribution. So this is an attack where it's trying to say, look, we're still in the game, and no matter how much land you take away from us in northern Syria, we will fight back. But as well as that, it's of course trying to just get into the headlines on its own terms. This is propaganda of the deed. It's propaganda which is essentially aiming to draw attention to the Islamic State cause, but point towards a consistent level of momentum and sustain this idea of triumphalism, that the Islamic State is moving forward, that it is more threatening than ever, and that it is still a viable jihadist organization. It's always thinking about what its audiences think of it. And we have to think of its terrorism as an extension of its propaganda in that sense.
And apparently in this statement that Islamic State issued, it says that this attack was made in response to an order of, I believe he's called the Emir, who is its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
Yes, so the statement does specifically say that the attack was carried out in accordance with or in response to an order from Amir al-Mu'mineen, so the Prince of the Believers, which is another title given to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State. And, I mean, I think, yes, that's clear that they're trying to draw a direct line between the Islamic State organization and the attacker. But I think we can also take that with a bit of a pinch of salt. I don't think that there was actually a direct order given. You could interpret that as just saying the individual who carried out the attack listened to a speech made by Baghdadi a couple of months ago, and then he carried out the attack in response to what Baghdadi said within those lines. But what's interesting is that it doesn't adopt the usual language that the Islamic State has used for attacks which have come to be spoken of as either inspired or virtually planned, depending on which way you see it. So the stabbing attacks, the lorry attacks, most recently in Berlin, of course, these were carried out by individuals who, according to the Islamic State, perpetrated the attack in response to various calls by the Islamic State to take retributive justice against the nations that are attacking it. Now, that wasn't the case with this attack. This attack was claimed, and the claim was rhetorically shrouded within this idea that it was about retribution, about vengeance, about attacking specifically Turkey because of its role in the war against the Islamic State. It was really trying to make as direct a line between the attacker and the organization as is possible. And I think the reference to Baghdadi is important, but I don't think that's the key thing. I think the key thing is how they actually spoke about the target itself.
Charlie Winter, research fellow at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization at King's College, London. Time now for us to check out social media. And to do that, Abby Lee is back with us in the studio after a short holiday break. We're happy to have you back in Studio 22. What's trending online, G?
Thanks, Jim. So singer Mariah Carey is still trending on Twitter. I know you talked about it with Lori yesterday, mm-hmm. but people are just not letting it go. So we are talking about the technical error that happened on New Year's Eve. And Carey's rep said the singer was set up to fail. But the production companies that was in charge of the event said that the claim is frankly absurd. Mm. Carey herself had a very cool response to the mishap, and she tweeted, "Here's to making more headlines in 2017. You know, you gotta love celebrities who can laugh at themselves.
Well, yeah, you have to do that. I mean, things happen, you know, mm-hmm. as she put it, and things did happen in a live performance, but that's kind of the fun of it.
I know, it is live, so what are you gonna do?
Right.
And then there is this New Yorker cartoon in the magazine that people are talking about. A person stands in the middle of an airplane and said, "These smug pilots have lost touch with regular passengers like us. Who thinks I should fly the plane?" And it also shows a lot of passengers agreeing with him. Some say the cartoonists capture the political climate very well, but others say the cartoon depicts U.S. President-elect Donald Trump quite unfairly. Many people also argued that actually a more accurate cartoon would be a bunch of people forced to vote between two pilots that aren't taking anyone where they want to go.
Bit harsh. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have time for one more item. What do you have?
There was a prison riot in Brazil that killed at least 60 people, and it was caused by fighting between two rival gangs. And the first mention about that incident appeared on Twitter about 6 hours ago. There is no specific hashtag for it, mm-hmm. but a good person to follow for the developing story is Gabriel Elizondo, who is a correspondent for Al Jazeera English. In one of his latest tweets, he wrote, "Possibly 130 inmates escaped in addition to the rising death toll." Jim?
Thanks for that great wrap-up, G. Be sure to follow her on Twitter at GAbbyLee. I'm out there as well at VOA Stevenson. And of course, follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia: Nepal and China to hold first ever military drill. China starts 2017 engulfed by smog and issues pollution alert. South Korea says women tied to scandal arrested in Denmark. Experts say North Korea's claim on ICBM tests is plausible. Activists say defamation cases surge in Myanmar. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app if you happen to have a smartphone. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The United States has called on North Korea to avoid provocative and inflammatory actions and words that threaten international peace and stability. That after North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said that test launch preparation for an intercontinental ballistic missile is in its last stage. Mr. Kim's remarks came in an annual televised New Year's Day address. But RAND Corporation security analyst Bruce Bennett tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Mr. Kim is getting ahead of the real state of North Korea's missile program.
The missile before the ICBM is the Musudan missile, which has much less range. And in 2016, he tested it 8 times. It failed 7 of the 8. So I think North Korea's still got some problems with their design of ballistic missiles that they've got to sort out. But they might sort it out early in 2017. We really don't know. So Kim Jong-un is obviously anxious to move ahead with an ICBM test.
Is the Musudan a threat to U.S. territory?
To Guam, it certainly is, and to U.S. military bases in Japan or Korea, it could be used there as well.
Of course, 2016 was a very missile-rich time for North Korea.
Oh, absolutely. Over 35 ballistic missile tests. If you count all of the ballistic missiles they tested, yeah, it was very rich.
What does this tell you about the status of their program?
First of all, they've made good progress on their Scud and Nodong, the shorter-range missiles, the missiles up to about 1,500-kilometer range. Those seem to be proving to be pretty reliable, but they're still struggling with the longer-range missiles. That said, it's a program making progress, so I think the U.S. needs to take a very hard line against it.
Bruce, a U.S. State Department spokeswoman on Sunday called on the North to refrain from provocative actions and inflammatory rhetoric that threatened international peace and stability. She went on to say that all states must use every available channel and means of influence to make clear to the DPRK and its enablers that launches using ballistic missile technology are unacceptable, and there was a call for return to talks. What do you think?
I don't think that's any different from what we've heard in the past. I think if that's the position we take, North Korea is going to proceed right on. I think we need to take a harder position.
What impact have sanctions had? North Korea has been under some form of sanctions since 2006.
The problem with sanctions is that sanctions depend upon trade. And most of North Korea's trade, 95 or so percent of its trade, is with China. And China does not generally implement the sanctions. It usually chooses not to because the sanctions would hurt Chinese economy in the Northeast, which is the poorest part of China. So China's got economic incentives not to do it, but it also has some political incentives not to. It's not particularly happy with the U.S. right now, and so it's not going to probably do anything serious.
Bruce Bennett also said the incoming administration of President-elect Donald Trump has a range of options to deal with future tests, including what he calls the extreme measure of attempting to shoot down a missile, depriving Pyongyang of valuable information. He said that could force the North back to the negotiating table. The new year is certain to bring some new advancements in treating people with liver cancer. Current methods being investigated range from developing an artificial liver to seeing if genetically modified pigs can produce organs compatible with humans. VOA's Carol Pearson reports on yet another approach being taken at the University of Missouri.
For those who have liver cancer, their only cure lies in a liver transplant or removal of the cancerous part of the organ. Both require major surgery, and patients who get a transplant will need to take immunosuppressant drugs for the rest of their lives. However, scientists are working on a new approach that is minimally invasive. With both chemotherapy and radiation, healthy cells around the tumor are damaged. But this approach involves the use of natural, non-toxic chemical compounds from plants. Katesh Kati, a professor at the University of Missouri School of Medicine, led a study that used nanotechnology to target and destroy precancerous tumor cells in the livers of mice and in vitro human cells.
It sounds like a fairy tale, but we are really in advanced stages in terms of tumor treatment, in terms of disease diagnostics.
Kati's work involved very small particles of gold encapsulated in a protective stabilizer from an acacia tree. The particles attract precancerous and malignant cells, which are far more susceptible to lower levels of heat than healthy cells.
The patient would be administered with these nanoparticles. Within a couple of hours, the patient would be treated with lasers, and then the patient can go home. So there is no radioactivity, there is no toxic waste, there is no systemic toxicity to the patient.
Kati says the cost of treatment will be low because 1 gram of gold can be used to treat 50 patients. And what's more, Kati says this type of treatment could be used for other types of cancer, for arthritis and other debilitating diseases. The next step is a clinical trial in humans. Should this technique work, it will be good news for the nearly 800,000 people who are diagnosed with liver cancer each year, and it could help save the lives of some 700,000 people who die each year from the disease. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Carol also has some great video with this story, and if you're interested, check it out at voanews.com. Exciting potential in liver cancer treatment. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new film based on the acclaimed children's novel A Monster Calls has opened in theaters. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, this film tells the story of a boy coming to terms with his mother's terminal illness.
Connor O'Malley has been plagued by nightmares. The 13-year-old shy, artistic boy is also the victim of his school bully. At 7 minutes past midnight, Connor keeps hearing a voice call to him from his bedroom window, which overlooks a churchyard with a giant yew tree. One night, Connor meets a monster, a massive tangle of roots and branches in human form. The monster tells Connor that he summoned it, and it will help him by telling him three short stories. In return, Connor must tell stories of his own. As Connor and the monster continue to meet, almost always at 12:07 a.m., we learn that Connor's mother, played by Felicity Jones, has terminal cancer. Connor is forced to move in with his cold, emotionally detached grandmother, played by Sigourney Weaver. The monster's stories are intended to teach the boy about life, but they continue to have increasing consequences, including the smashing of his grandmother's living room and the attacking of his nemesis at school. Liam Neeson provides the voice of the monster.
I don't know if you've read the book by Patrick Ness. It's an extraordinary, it really is like a classic book. And it just, you know, you close over the last page, and certainly with me, it just really gets you thinking about aspects of your life.
When Connor tells his own nightmare, he begins to confront his feelings about his mother's imminent death. The monster reveals that he has been sent to help Connor heal, and when the boy accepts his mother's terminal illness, she dies in the hospital at 7 minutes after midnight. Newcomer Lewis McDougall plays Connor.
I guess really I would use like experiences in my own life to try and understand what Connor's feeling, but you know, also there was the fact that I had to do an English accent, which I'm Scottish, of course, and so I had to do a bit of dialect coaching for that, and I actually had a couple weeks of rehearsals with everybody, including Liam, and so that was very helpful.
Neeson says that McDougall embodied the nuances and the emotions Connor experiences in a way not usually seen in child actors.
Terrific kid, and what a performance he gives. I mean, I've made quite a few movies with quite a few children. This boy is brilliant. He really is. It's a brilliant performance.
Sigourney Weaver says that she, director J.A. Bayona, and Felicity Jones did their homework to make sure that their performances were true to life.
You know, Felicity and I and Bayona, we did meet with doctors in England cancer specialists. We also went to hospice to see what the challenges of taking care of someone in the last stages of cancer would be. So we did kind of fill up on that, and I know she also met with women survivors of cancer.
A Monster Calls is based on the book by Patrick Ness, who also wrote the Chaos Walking series for children. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
We could not present International Edition without our great director, Tracy Carter, and our veteran engineer, Dave Magnus. Thank you, gentlemen. Greatly appreciate it. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You can follow us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, too, at VOA_IE. We thank you the most for being with us today, and we hope you have a wonderful day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Much has changed in the 35 years since a terrible new disease, known today as HIV/AIDS, was identified. Before, an HIV/AIDS diagnosis was a death sentence. A person with HIV often lived less than a year after it progressed to AIDS. Today, nearly half of the 37 million people living with HIV/AIDS receive life-saving HIV treatment, allowing them normal lives. Through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, the United States has been at the forefront of the global response. PEPFAR is the largest commitment by any nation to combat a single disease in history, said U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator Ambassador Deborah Birx. Recent data show the epidemic is becoming controlled in several key African countries, demonstrating the remarkable impact of PEPFAR's investments. Indeed, achieving an AIDS-free generation is now within our reach. Driven by research and data, our collective efforts have saved millions of lives and are turning the tide against HIV/AIDS, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith. Today, PEPFAR is supporting 11.5 million people globally with life-saving treatment. The good news is, according to a recent UNAIDS report, infections in children globally have dropped 51% between 2010 and 2015. Simultaneously, annual AIDS-related deaths fell from 2 to 1.11 million. The bad news is the virus is spreading among young women in sub-Saharan Africa. According to a recent UNAIDS report, last year nearly 1 in 5 new infections worldwide occurred in women between the ages of 15 and 24. Adolescent girls and young women account for nearly 75% of new HIV infections among adolescents in sub-Saharan Africa. This is concerning, as the 15 to 24-year-old population in sub-Saharan Africa will have doubled by 2020. There are many reasons for the alarming rates of new HIV infections among young women, including gender-based violence, exclusion from economic opportunities, insufficient access to health care, even a lack of access to secondary education. So, through PEPFAR, the United States is working with its partners to reduce, by the end of 2017, new HIV infections among adolescent girls and young women by 40% in the highest HIV burden areas of 10 sub-Saharan African countries. It's the first time the U.S. government has ever set specific targets for preventing new HIV infections among this group, underscoring the U.S. global strategy to empower adolescent girls. With our partners, we can sustain an enduring legacy of American leadership, compassion, and determination, said USAID Administrator Smith. Together, we can end AIDS worldwide by 2030.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.